Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we visit with Vijay Pandian. He is back with us once again. Great to have him along. He's the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. And we're going to talk about a lot of things with him. We can always kind of go all over the map, but I do want to visit a bit about buckthorn and maybe some other invasives and maybe how to get rid of them. It's probably the question I get most often in terms of getting rid of something is how do we get rid of buckthorn? So we'll deal some more with that today and take your gardening questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Vijay Pandian, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here.
Tell you what, buckthorn, I really do think we get more questions about that miserable plant than almost anything.
Yeah, you're not the only one, actually.
You do, too.
Almost one-third of my calls in Brown County is related to buckthorn.
Is that right?
It's pretty widespread in our state, actually, you know, and it's kind of naturalized completely in our ecosystem. And you can spot out buckthorn anytime. I mean, it's one of the last plant to shed its leaves. So even when you take a drive, you know, even in the late fall in November, you will be able to spot out buckthorn because that's the only one still has a green leaf. And also early in the spring, that's the only plant actually leaves out much earlier. So you could spot it out anywhere in our landscape, in parks, you know, open areas, dry land, wetlands, marshes, everywhere. You know, this is one of the highly invasive plants that's kind of completely adapted to our ecosystem. You know, the unfortunate part is that we don't have a good biological way to control this plant.
Yeah.
So we have to rely upon either some sort of like, you know, mechanical or manual way or chemical way to deal with these buckthorns.
And they are so miserable. Where do they come from?
Well, they actually, you know, originated from Europe.
Okay.
And back in like in 1800, 1845, it was actually introduced as an ornamental plant. So it has this more like an upright growth characteristic. So it was introduced as an ornamental plant for hedging purpose. But one thing didn't realize that the berries are very invasive. They're quick to spread by the birds as well as the wildlife. And so it started to spread easily into our native ecosystem and start displacing all our wildlife. So this buckthorn, if you look, there are two different common type of invasive buckthorns are there. One is a common buckthorn. Another one is a glassy buckthorn. Now, the name, the buckthorn, is very interesting because it attributes to the bud, how it looks like. So if you look at the bud of a common buckthorn, it looks actually like a hoof of a buck. And if you look at the terminal end of those branches in the common buckthorn, between those two hoofs, there is a small thorn. That's how it gets the name.
Oh,
buckthorn.
That's how it gets the name.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Lisa and Racine has a question relating to buckthorn, so let's go there to her. Hi, Lisa. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for your show. I'm just wondering if there's an easy way to differentiate between buckthorn and choke cherry. I've just seen in pictures, and they look very similar, and I'm just wondering, is there an easy way to tell which is which?
Of course, actually. See, if you look into a buckthorn, their leaves are almost, you know, opposite. And sometimes it could be alternate, but most of the common buckthorn leaves are alternate, are opposite. And if you look at the veins of the leaf on the buckthorn, that looks like more like a sickle-shaped appearance or more of a paddle-shaped appearance. And that's another key thing to differentiate. And as I indicated just a minute ago, if you look at the buds, especially the terminal buds of the common buckthorn, you will find actually a small tiny thorn, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the another distinguished characteristic that can differentiate between a buckthorn versus chokecherry, because chokecherry doesn't have all those kind of characteristics just like buckthorn does. However, the berries of the chokecherry, the black chokecherry as well as the buckthorn, kind of look similar, which is more purple, blackish and purple in color. The other thing, if you look into a mature common buckthorn, you will find some big spines actually right on the trunk areas. And also in the common buckthorn, you will also find some the white spots, actually, which we call the lenticels, okay, on the buckthorn stems. So these are some of the morphological characteristics that you can differentiate between a common buckthorn versus a choke cherry.
And the choke cherry doesn't last as long in the, doesn't it die out kind of or lose leaves and so forth before the buckthorn?
Of course, in a buckthorn is the last one to leaf out, drop its leaf, but a choke cherry, probably by now, you know, you will start to see the leaves in it changing its color and dropping down. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or if you've got a photo or a question you want to post on our Facebook page, please go ahead and do that, and we'll take a look at it, and maybe we can do some identification. Or maybe if you've just got a nice-looking fall photo of your garden, that'd be fun to see, too. Put it up on our Facebook page. Deb on Facebook, by the way, writes, "Help, my farm is covered in black and woody nightshade. What do I do?"
Well, first of all, try to identify what species of nightshade you have. You know, we have about like, you know, three or four different species of nightshade. And one of the common nightshade that seems to be very problematic, you know, is the one which winds around the trees as well as the fences and those kind of things. So, in fact, those kind of woody nightshades are, you know, perennial in nature. So if you do want to control them, this is the best time to control them because all those nutrients getting translocated into the roots right now. So if you do apply some foliar herbicide, you know, either a spot treatment with some Roundup, then probably the Roundup gets translocated into the root system and knocks those things out. Or the other thing you can do, you can cut them actually down to the ground and paint it immediately or do a spot spray immediately with the Roundup too. In that way, you avoid the drift actually onto your desired plant too. So there are some couple of options you can do to control those woody ones.
Yeah. Good. Let's go to Andy in Brookfield next. Andy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
I've got a piece of property north of here that I've got autumn olive on it, and it really makes buckthorn tail by comparison. The stuff is so prolific, and it leaves out early, just like buckthorn, but it's just taking over. And I've been using a Gylon product on it, but I guess I'd like your guest to comment on autumn olive and where it's at in the state. I know it's pretty much on the east side of the state right now, but I guess I'd just like to get some of his thoughts on it.
Sure.
Well, of course, autumn olive is also very invasive too, and I came across in a some populations of autumn olive in Brown County, but not very extensive. So if you let the autumn olive and buckthorn to battle against each other, I would have to make my bet on buckthorn, okay, because it's comparatively adaptable even to shade, full sun, wet, dry.
Yeah.
Whereas autumn olive, you know, only to a certain extent it can adapt. Certainly it won't take in a deep shade or anything like that. But the management, you know, is of course is similar to buckthorn. Say, if you want to spray with some Gylon, you can do it right now. Either you can use a cut stump method. If you have a, you know, large size trunk of more than 6 inches, you cut them down to the ground and immediately spray it. Or you can do a basal bark drenching method too. Again, if you use a basal bark drenching method about 18 inches above the ground, you paint the bark completely or spray the bark completely with the Gylon 4, but you need to make sure to mix some oil to it. Like a basal bark oil needs to be mixed into it so that the oil helps in penetrating that Gylon 4 into the bark too. Of course, you know, like buckthorn, the autumn olive seeds can be spread quite easily by the birds, and though it looks pretty, but
Does it look like, by the way, the autumn olive? What does it appear to be?
Have you seen the Russian olive? The Russian olive leaves have more of a silvery appearance, whereas the autumn olive leaves, you know, are more lanceolate too, but it does have a little bit of dark glossy leaf and a little bit of silvery tinge to it. The berries actually look like a rosy pink in color, actually, mm-hmm. tiny one, so it kind of looks has a little bit attractiveness to it. But it is very invasive. It also even suckers too. So
yeah, if you cut it off, you have to kill it because it'll come up worse, just like buckthorn.
Yeah, you need to take care of the re-sprout in the following season back again. You know, any woody invasive plant species does need to be need to do at least 2 or 3 years of follow up.
Unfortunately, much, Andy.
I'm taking it as a maintenance item as opposed to an eradication item because I've been killing it for years and you can't kill it all. It's just impossible. Too many berries and too much on adjoining properties. So.
Yeah, that's the problem, the adjoining properties. You can be doing a great job, but if your neighbor isn't.
Yeah.
Exactly. The birds don't stay put. They do their duty whenever they have to.
Yeah. I mean, when we come to invasive species, it's more of a communal issue. It is not like one gardener's issue or one community issue. It actually affects it throughout the society. So, you know, we may have to join forces with the neighborhoods, okay, into tackling these invasive species. And if not, it's tough to battle against these plants.
Yeah, it definitely is. But it's got to start somewhere. And Andy, at least it started with Andy in his neighborhood. Maybe you can get some more people on board with it. Thanks, Andy.
Okay, thank you.
We will go to Alan in La Crosse next. Hi, Alan. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was calling to find out, I know there are a lot of invasive species that have other uses, either edible, medicinal, foraging-wise.
Yep.
Is there any uses to buckthorn? And I will take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, I remember 4 or 5 years ago in Brown County, they introduced goats, actually, to control the buckthorns because the goat liked to forage on the leaves of the buckthorns, actually, too. So it was used as one of the way to, you know, control the young buckthorn seedlings, okay? So certainly, you know, you have some herbivore species to forage onto it. If you do have a large-sized trees, you know, when you cut down those trees of a buckthorns, you can use that for making some wooden potteries. My predecessor, Paul Hartman, actually, and I showed me some of those pottery that he made actually out of those buckthorn stumps and wood. So that's interesting to see. And I've seen many homeowners actually use those stumps of the buckthorn and the branches of the buckthorn for training some vegetable crops actually after they cut down the buckthorn. So you can use for trellis making, things like that too.
Oh, sure.
So that's another nice way to recycle some of those, you know, one. But as far as the medicinal purpose, I'm sorry, I don't have any idea on that.
Yeah, I haven't heard of anything either. So, but there are some other good uses for it once you get rid of it and cut it down so it's not going to grow back.
Yeah.
Ben in Mequon, your turn. Hi, Ben.
Hi. About a dozen years ago, the Wisconsin DNR published a list of all invasive plants found in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And when they published that list, it was stipulated in that list that it's up to individual municipalities to pass their ordinances for landowners to take care of their problems. And very few municipalities have acted on this. Now, you opened the program about controlling or getting rid of buckthorn, or any invasive for that matter. You're never going to get rid of them unless you have all of your surrounding landowners taking care of the problem, or it's going to come right back. My point is, if you're really concerned about invasive plants, you know, get your community involved. Request that your municipalities do some ordinance enforcements or get some ordinances on the books in the first place. Otherwise, as I say, you're wasting your time and energy trying to control it.
Exactly, Mr. Ben. You know, the Wisconsin DNR has introduced actually some new, legislative laws actually, you know, through the Congress, and about, certain invasive species, they have in a listed as prohibited species, which means that you are strictly, you know, you cannot, you know, let those invasive species to grow in your property or in your community. And if you do so, then you will be penalized and you'll be forced to remove it. But, you know, as you know, a lot of other invasive species have already established, and it's not easy to remove those things, actually. So the DNR, you know, the second category is they introduce a law on restricted species, which means that there are certain invasive species which are already naturalized, like buckthorn, honeysuckles, garlic mustard, you know. So according to those are called restricted species. According to that, you know, you are not supposed to transport them. You are not supposed to, you know, sell those invasive plants anywhere else, okay? And though they don't enforce it to control it, but they highly encourage you. Now, you hit right on the nail on this one. We need to create awareness about this invasive species, why it's more threatening in our community. And we need to encourage our government officials and, you know, all those county board people to help in controlling this invasive species. So, and I think, you know, if we do have a strong law, that's going to really help, actually, in, you know, minimizing the spread of these invasive species in our community.
Yeah, nail on the head there. Thanks, Ben. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, Sharon Morrissey from Milwaukee County UW Extension will be back with us to take your gardening questions. Right now, visiting with Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on Garden Talk. Tim in Whitewater has a comment, so let's go there. Tim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. We've got a ton of it down south of Whitewater. We're on the very edge of the southern Kettle Moraine, and so there's a lot of ridges that run along there that were never farmed, and so, you know, they're just full of it. A lot of houses built in there. We actually we cut it down, let it dry for 6 months, and then run it through a wood chipper and use it for mulch. You got to be careful. You know, people said, "Well, you have berries, you're going to get it," but it's a nice red bark, and that works for us. I mean, and then you burn it in, you know, you burn the buckthorn in your fire pit. I mean, you got to let it dry because it crackles because it's got a lot of sap in it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, good points. Vijay, comment?
Yes, you know, the buckthorn woods are not really a strong wood, actually. You know, mm-hmm. They have a yellow color or orangish color sapwood in the middle. So, you know, it's also brooded too. The only thing I would cautious about is that, you know, if there is a way to separate those berries out of those mulch, that will be really helpful.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes those berries are the main the thing that spreads out the buckthorns in the community. Say, when you do move around those mulch, you know, be careful about those seeds or the berries that has been mixed into that.
Yeah, that's good points. Let's go to Chris and Spitzer next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you, Larry. I have a concern. Second caller before was on the municipalities passing ordinances and controlling some of this invasive species.
Yeah.
But yet the state and the county roadways are full of wild parsnip. And that doesn't get mowed usually until it goes to seed, and then it's worse the next year.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that is the case, Vijay.
You're right. That's another nastiest invasive weed, actually. And not only the nasty one, you know, it's also very hazardous to human health, you know, because the sap of those wild parsnip, when it touches our skin, you know, it causes mm-hmm. that photophytodermatitis, actually. It means basically the sap, when it touches the skin, it becomes, you create all sort of rashes and everything. Now, the problem is, you know, it's a mowing timing. If you mow them at the right timing, that is actually as soon as they form the flower heads, okay, or before it goes to seed production, then probably you can able to limit its spread. But oftentimes what happens, it happens after they all set the seeds, and then the local municipality folks comes and mows in. So what they're literally doing, they're thinking of controlling it, but rather you're spreading the seed, actually. So every year it keeps
worse.
On getting, you know, spread out, actually.
So right, Chris is exactly right.
Yeah. Say, I think they need to be aware about it, but oftentimes, you know, what I hear from their side of the story is that, you know, they don't have enough time, and so they are also facing some logistic issues on their end, you know, so it's a tough one. It's a tough one.
Yeah, and very, very difficult, but still think it's solvable. If you want to put your mind to it, you can get the timing down. Let's, Bob emailed, by the way. He's clearing an area along his back property line. It's very dense with buckthorn. And after he clears a section and burns the buckthorn, it seems to create problems because now there's regular sunlight coming back as a carpet of small buckthorn plants come in. Any suggestions on how to handle it?
Okay. This is a common scenario that I face all the time from many homeowners. You know, they have wooded areas and it's filled with buckthorn. Where do I start with? You know, you need to have a good management plan, 4 to 5 years minimum of a good management plan, and you need to strategize it. So when you have a heavily thicketed buckthorn, I would start from the outside or the edges of your property first, and try to remove some of those buckthorn from outside. In the meantime, in the first year, also focus on if you do have any large trees or buckthorn. Buckthorn can get about 20, 25 feet tall.
Yeah.
So selectively remove those things also in the first year too. Now, there are a lot of control techniques you can use. Either you can use a cut stump, basal bark, or if it's a young seedlings, okay, you can also do some spray either in the growing season, or if you're allergic to spray, you can also manually hand pull if you have a lot of time. The second year, go to the next round, go to the innermost of the, you know, of your property and start removing it. So you strategize, you know, your work, okay, starting from outside, selectively remove some of the large trees, and then go forward inward. So if you do about 3-4 years, okay, you will able to remove most of the buckthorn, and then come back in fifth year again to the outside, because you're going to see a lot of resprouts coming back again.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about a minimum 5 to 6 years you need to work in your property, and you need to strategize them if you really want to control these buckthorns in a very effective way.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Dick in Barron County has something for us. Hi, Dick.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
I want to echo the comment of someone earlier that talked about the need to get some municipalities involved. And even go further than that, it would be nice to see some legislative action that would at least alert landowners to the danger of it and encourage them to get busy on it. Now, they talked about how heavy it is down in southern Wisconsin. I can tell you up here in Barron County and surrounding areas that it is very dense in areas, especially along the rivers. Gets so dense that you can't walk through it. It literally creates a wall of trees, which no wildlife are going to use. It's a great detriment to the value of your public property. We've been a little successful in getting some hunting groups interested, but it's just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
Exactly, you're right. You know, these buckthorns, you know, they can form a really in a huge thickets actually of growth. And the biggest problem also, especially on the riverside, is that, you know, since this buckthorn grows so thick, it doesn't allow some of the native vegetation that used to protect our soil from erosion. So once you get rid of all those, you know, native vegetations, you know, you're going to see a tremendous amount of, you know, topsoil nearby the river's area getting eroded and mixed in. So that's going to cause a huge issue, you know, environmental issue. And second of all, you're right, you know, it displaces a lot of wildlife habitat too. So it is a very serious issue in our state, and I think, you know, we need to address it, you know, not from the, you know, legislative perspective, but also from local perspective too. We need to have some more like a, a communal approach, you know, in handling these buckthorns and trying to find an effective way, you know, to get rid of them and strategize them in the controlling these buckthorns.
Yeah. I think it's a good, Dick's got a good idea there with it, involving local organizations or local clubs. They're involving some local hunting clubs, and that's
I've been in touch with Whitetails Unlimited, and they're producing an article now and then. QDMA, the Quality Deer Management Group, also have been alerting their membership. The biggest thing is you can invest all kind of money that you want in some hunting land and have food plots and everything. But if buckthorn takes over, the deer are not going to go to those food plots except at night.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, one thing I would suggest, think about it, is that after you remove some of the buckthorn, try to restore back that with some native plant species. Try to reseed that area if possible, so that, you know, it can outcompete, try to at least outcompete the any of the respots coming up from the buckthorns. And do a follow-up. You know, oftentimes we forget about the follow-up. You know, try to do a follow-up a year after when you do see some of those new growth coming back. It's easy to control the new growth rather than actually an established one. So if not, all your efforts will go in waste, you know, if you don't do any follow-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets so thick underneath that even buckthorn seeds won't germinate.
Dick, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. Molly in Grand Marais, Minnesota, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Molly.
Hi. Thank you for the show. It's great. We get you across the lake. We had an incident with cow parsnip, the native cow parsnip. Somebody thought it was the toxic one because it's a double umbel, you know, plant. It's quite magnificent. They came in the first year and cut off all the tops, and we thought at first that must be some craft project. Couldn't figure it out. It's in a public park. But the next year they came in and sprayed it with herbicide. Mm-hmm. No permission was asked, no questions, just people came in and did this anonymously. So I want to just warn people that cow parsnip is white. It's a native plant, and it doesn't harm you. And it's pretty scary to have someone come in and do their own control in a public park.
Yeah, well, that should not happen in a public park. You should be getting permission and talking to the right people, VJ.
Exactly. You need to contact the park official and make sure, you know, these plants, get the park official be aware about it and properly identify those things. You know, people usually confuse between a wild parsnip, cow parsnip, and the giant hogweed. They all look similar, you know, especially the cow parsnip and the giant hogweed, their flower heads looks very similar too, except the giant hogweed leaves and flowers are so big, okay, that you cannot, you know, miss it. And very few areas in our state we have that. But the cow parsnip, you know, you will find them, you know, starting to bloom somewhere from, you know, late May all the way till about early July, you will start to see those things in bloom. Whereas a wild parsnip, you will start to see them probably beginning in about early July. And the flower heads of the wild parsnip, as you know, it's pretty, you know, yellowish in color, whereas a cow parsnip is a white. And cow parsnip in particular, they like to grow more in a moist area, shaded moist areas in the landscape, pot shaded. Whereas a wild parsnip made more adjacent in a dry areas, like a roadside, ditches, you know, in prairie areas, you know, more in a full sunny settings, actually. So those are some key characteristics that we can differentiate the habitat of wild parsnips and cow parsnip.
Yeah, Molly, thank you. Thanks very much for calling. And move into some other areas here. We had an email from Cloudcatcher in Fox Point, and she wonders about transplanting asters. Is now a good time to transplant asters?
Well, I mean, I would better wait till spring to do those things. I mean, that is not enough time, actually, for those, you know, new transplant to get reacclimatized to the new location. Usually our grounds begins to freeze around like end of November, early December. So that is not enough time, I would say. So if you can, wait till about like in a mid to late April to do the transplanting.
I have my lime tree sitting out on my second floor deck yet, and I'm going to leave it out there till it's frost, you know. But what about moving plants indoors? Are there certain plants that you ought to be thinking about moving if you're going to move them indoors?
Of course, actually, some of the tropical hibiscus, which is one of the most common one many homeowners used to, you know, buy, and they want to save those in a tropical hibiscus. They should have been moved as early as in September, actually, or as soon as we start to see a dip in night temperature. So many of these tropical, you know, type of plants, and when you start to see a dip in night temperature of about 65 degree, that's a good time to move them inside. Move them into a bright sunny areas and so that they can get a lot of light. Make sure your indoor room temperature is at least 70 degrees. Whereas if you're talking about subtropical plants like your, you know, limes and those kind of plants, or even like if you're non-hardy figs and those kind of things, then probably you can wait till the night temperature gets about like 40 degrees or something like that, or even close to frost, and then you can bring them back inside, or you can put them into a cool basement so they get dark, or you can bring them back into a normal room temperature so it can stay green throughout the, you know, winter time too.
We had Chris on Facebook writing, a lot of the plants in planters in front of businesses are able to be wintered over. I'm going to go around to the places in my little town the day before the first hard freeze and bring them in for the winter, much to my glee. I did this with some tuberous begonias last winter, let them go dormant, and with a little spring rain, I had instant pots to put outside. What do you think of that?
That's great, actually. Many of these non-hardy tuberous bulbs, like begonias, dahlias, you know, I mean, if you already have in a small size planters, you know, you just scoop them out, bring them back inside, and once in spring comes in, you can late spring comes in, you can directly, you know, plant them back again there. You can do some sort of those kind of tricks, and when you're putting back again for winter inside your house, either place it in a cool basement so that the bulbs, you know, be dormant. Sometimes you place in a sunny window, so what happens is that when you have a normal room temperature, these things may sprout back again, and you're basically depleting the energy out of the bulb. So when you do plant them in the spring, then late spring, they won't have enough energy to produce a flower. Okay, say let them make sure, let it be dormant in the wintertime in your cool basement. Since in the last few years, we are having a mild winter, and in many big areas and municipalities and cities, they have a huge planters, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, if you do have a mild winter, and maybe if you have a huge planters, maybe you can try to overwinter them right up there, as long as the bulbs are planted a little bit deeper and has some winter protection. I tried it with some few bulbs, you know, but 50-50. It's a bit of a risky. You know, you never know how the winter is going to be, you know.
Vijay Pandya and our guest, you can join in with your gardening questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org if you want to post a question and or a photo on our Facebook page. Just please do that. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can post there. Can also post on our new Facebook page, and I hope you'll like our new page when you go to it. We have a page that covers all of the shows, and it's available to you right now, as a matter of fact. Bill in Columbia County has something for you. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have some very weird neighbors who keep peering at us in the backyard, and I want a 25-foot-tall screen. What can I plant that will grow that tall and provide screening very quickly?
Okay.
Bill, is it a full sunny area or is it a part shade? And whether the site is a moist or dry site?
It is clay soils that can be a little wet in the spring. They get a full 8 hours of sun.
Okay, gotcha. You know, if you feel that, you know, in the springtime it's going to be constantly wet in that area, I would suggest you to construct a little bit of a berm and plant, you know, a row of arborvitaes. And there are a lot of different types of arborvitaes available, you know, from emerald green to, you know, a lot of different kinds of that, say, technique arborvitaes. So, you know, and these arborvitaes can give you an excellent, you know, screening purpose, you know, throughout the winter time too. But the only one thing about the arborvitae is that they don't like wet feet. So, like this year, if you have constantly, you know, wet weather in the early part of, you know, June, July, probably you will see a lot of arborvitaes collapsing down. So that'll be my first choice, but make sure to construct some sort of like a berm so that it allows some better drainage of some excess moisture and have some arborvitae over there too. So that'll give you a good screening.
Now, with a berm, how high would a berm would you need?
Probably about, you know, 12 inches is good
okay,
enough.
About
you know,
a foot.
About a foot is good enough, you know.
What about bamboo? I've been reading about some cold, hardy bamboos.
You know, you have to be very careful with that. You know, oftentimes people say about cold, hardy bamboo, Japanese bamboo, they are referring to invasive plant called the Japanese knotweed, which you don't want that.
No.
So, and if you're really looking for some sort of like a bamboo one, they are not hardy for our area. They're more in for southern part of the United States. So verify what type of bamboo they are talking about. I can't remember any bamboo that is really hardy for area. Now, there are other type of plants that you can think about. Some of the tall shrubs like Cornelian cherry dogwood. It's one of the beautiful shrubs that I really like. It gets about like 15, 20 feet tall. And it in the springtime, it produces tiny, tiny white blossoms, actually. And it's a deciduous shrubs, and it can take, you know, full sun, part shade, or even a shaded areas really well, too. So you can use that as an alternative to arborvitae if you like.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thanks, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Christina in Glenwood City, you're next. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm hoping that you can give me a long-term plan to eliminate burdock plants from my Frisian horse's pasture. The burdocks create a tangled mess in their manes.
That's an excellent question. So the timing is more critical to control the burdock plant. So I would encourage you to spray in the fall time when the leaves are still green in color so that the herbicide gets translocated into the root system, gets knocked out. Now, if you do see any flowers or seed, cut them up right away and bag those seeds actually and you trash it. Before you trash it, put a label in that trash bag saying it's an invasive plant or so, you know, and then you trash it. And in terms of using herbicide, you can use like, you know, 2% glyphosate to, you can go all the way to 5 to 10% or even some people have used 25%, which is too excessive, I would say. Those are more for woody plant. Mm-hmm. Now, after you control this, you know, burdock, you know, think about having some sort of like a vegetation to fill in that area. Say if you're living in a prairie area, make sure to reseed back again, you know, with some other type of prairie seed mixes, either grass mixes or with some other wildlife type of prairie mixes back into it. Having an exposed area is more like inviting some more invasive plants or allowing some more weeds to grow back in that open area.
Yeah, good points. Thanks for calling, Christine. Appreciate your call. Vijay Pandey, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden here on Garden Talk with Vijay Pandey, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us. I think there's one open line at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Tom and Kiwani up next with a question. Hi, Tom.
Hey, guys. Hey, I have an acre of which is just grass. to the east to me that I'm looking to plant some apple trees and maybe some pear trees. Wanted to know, is there a certain distance that I should keep these things, like keep the apple trees a certain distance away from each other or the pear trees so that I can get some kind of a harvest off of them?
Okay.
That's a great question, Tom. You know, it all depends upon the rootstock that you're going to get with the apples. See, the rootstocks are the one that governs the, you know, the growth or the height of the plant. So when you buy an apple tree, let's say you're buying a Honeycrisp, it's always grafted with a rootstock. So good to know what type of rootstock you have. So there are basically three type of rootstock: dwarf, semi-dwarf, and standard rootstock. Dwarf rootstock plants gets about like 6 to 10 feet or 12 feet at the maximum. And your semi-dwarf from 10 to 20 feet. And a standard, don't go with a standard one. It takes, say, you know, 5-6 years to bloom and produce a fruit. And they get about 30 feet tall. Now, based on these type of rootstock, the spacing varies. If you're going with a dwarf type of rootstock, then probably you need at least 10 feet by 10 feet for each plant, you know, and the maximum I'm talking about. If you're going with a semi-dwarf, you need about like 20 feet by 20 feet at the maximum per plant. And dwarf more than like 400, 500 square feet, we're talking about that. So based on the rootstock, your spacing varies.
So I kind of like the dwarf varieties myself.
I mean, many homeowners like the dwarf one because it is easy to manage.
Yeah.
First of all, pruning. Always a headache in trying to have if you have a standard apple tree, pruning is a headache. But if you have a dwarf type that grows 6 to 8 feet, pruning is much easier. You can get done with the pruning within about half an hour. Second of all, apples are notorious for a lot of bugs and diseases. So if you have a dwarf one, easy to spray. Third thing, harvesting. If you remember those days, mm-hmm. actually, in a standard tree, you'd have to have a crane, actually, or a ladder to climb to yeah. harvest those things. When a dwarf, you don't need those things, actually, you know. So it's easier to manage your dwarf apple trees in a backyard.
Okay, so what you're kind of saying is then they should be about 10 feet apart or no further than 10 feet apart from each other?
Yeah, if it's a dwarf.
Yeah, if you're getting a dwarf type of apple trees, yes.
Sure, awesome. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. So, in an acre, you can get a few in there.
Oh yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a few. Steve in Ives Grove, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yes, my question revolves around the cut stump method of eradicating the buckthorn. I have buckthorn that's growing under the canopy of some desirable maple trees and also desirable conifer trees, and I wonder if the herbicide that's applied to the stump after you cut it will transmit through the roots and kill the trees I'd like to keep?
That's a good question. And no, it doesn't actually translocate to your desired maple trees or your conifer tree that you have. So basically in a cut stump, you should do somewhere like in mid to late fall, you cut only the buckthorn stump all the way to the ground and you paint actually using a spray brush or something, you paint only the stump of the buckthorn. Use a concentrated version of glyphosate, about 20-25% concentrate, or you can use Garland too. And you just, you know, spray the stump alone or paint the stump alone. And that should do the trick, actually, because that, you know, the Roundup, the glyphosate gets translocated only into the root system of the buckthorn and knocks most of the roots of the buckthorn only. So it doesn't get translocated, actually, into the roots of your maple or conifer. Now, so sometimes people make mistake by drenching quite a bit or pouring quite a bit around the stump. And maybe, when you're drench quite a bit where it leaches into the soil, then there's a light risk actually where the roots of a maple and conifer can absorb. So you just, only if you do spray or paint only on the stump, then you should be fine.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. VJ, you were showing me a couple of photos of some vegetables that you planted this year that looked pretty good to me. One's called Mad Hatter. It's a pepper, sweet pepper, right?
Yes, it is. Actually, it is planted by my master gardeners, actually. They have a demonstration garden plot at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. They call it a small space garden. And they planted an interesting pepper this year called Mad Hatter. And this pepper is from South American origin. And it's a nice sweet green bell pepper. It has like three sides to it. And it looks like a bell shape, you know. And yeah. So when you cut them, you'll find like a, you know, three pockets inside. So it's great for stuffing. And once it's allowed to ripe, usually, you know, it ripes actually only by first week in October, it seems like, okay, in our region. And it is the sweetest bell pepper that you can taste.
Oh, it's called Mad Hatter.
Mad Hatter. So, and it is very prolific. And in terms of yield, it's constantly keeps on producing in the beginning and from August. So even our master gardeners are still harvesting, actually, at this time of the year right now. My one of my master gardeners who brought into my office yesterday and about this. So it's a very interesting pepper. And I think
it's one to keep in mind for next year.
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful looking, has a little ornamental touch to it. So you can keep it in your kitchen counter table, too. It's very attractive. And people, it's gonna captivate your guest or your family members, wondering what this weird looking pepper looks like.
And then you have a kind of a stranger looking cucumber as well.
Yeah, it's like a looks like a mini watermelon, about a size of 2 inches, and it's called the Mexican sour gherkin. And my master gardener planted in a, at the old extension office, and it's one of the sweetest tasting in a cucumber. It is not really sour unless if you stress the plant out. So this whole summer, whenever I go to the demonstration garden, it's just like a, you know, like a tiny, you know, watermelon that you can pop into your mouth, and it tastes really delicious. And it's packed actually with a sweetness, and it's watery. It's amazing, actually. And you can allow them to climb on any trellis, and it doesn't need that much of space either. So I think it's one of the, you know, if you're having a small space garden, I think this is one of the small, you know, neat plant that you can have, which does not need that much of huge space to grow or wind around the trellis either.
And it's called what again?
Mexican sour gherkin.
Mexican sour?
Yeah.
Sour, S-O-A-R?
Yeah, S-O-U-R.
S-O-U, oh, sour.
Sour gherkin.
All right. I've got that. I wrote that down because I want to try that next year. John in Madison has a question. Let's go there. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Quick question in regards to a cottonwood tree that's on my property. It's kind of one that started on its own, got neglected, and I've finally figured out it was there. And I'd like to take it down, and I'm wondering if I can... well, what I'm thinking is actually killing it before I cut it. So what would I use to treat that to kill it out so I can kill it and cut it as a dry?
How big is it?
At the base, it's probably, I would say, maybe 12 inches.
Oh, so it's big. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well... If you do have a large size type of tree like that, you know, probably sometimes I would let some professionals to handle that, you know, because cottonwoods are notorious for a lot of different, you know, it has a very weak branching structures, you know, and it has a lot of disease issues, you know, and the wood is not really, you know, strong either. It's very brittle. So you need to be very careful when you cut down those cottonweeds, okay, and depending upon how tall you have. Now, if you do want to, you know, spray onto those cottonwoods and to do it by yourself, you know, I think probably I would still recommend to go with a cut stump method. You cut the cottonwood to the base to the ground and spray the stump with some concentrated glyphosate of 20 to 25% concentrated version. And definitely these, if you have a well-established cottonweed, even with that concentrated spray, you're going to see some sprouts coming back, you know, from the roots, you know, from the falling season. So in the falling season, you know, if you do see some of the new growth coming up from the roots, you know, respray them back again, or you keep moving them down.
And would you, I suppose long-term, you could probably just debark around the tree and let it die a natural death.
You can also do that too. Yeah, so you can debark those things. Yeah, all the way around.
It's just, you'd have to go all the way around.
All the way around. It's a basically a girdling method, you know, that you're doing.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Bill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I want to get a quick clarification on the glyphosate for the buckthorn.
Yeah.
If I go out and buy the 20 or 25% solution of glyphosate, do I just use that out of the bottle? Or if I mix it, it's going to come down to like 1% because it's 2 ounces per gallon.
It depends upon, what size of buckthorn you're handling with. If you're thinking about treating a buckthorn which has a trunk size of more than 6 inches or more, then probably you use straight out of the bottle with a 20-25% concentrate. You don't have to dilute it. Now, if you're using for like a basal drench technique, then you need to dilute it to 5-6% type of concentrate so that you can use it for basal drench technique. Now, if you're using for foliar application, you can further dilute to 2-3% concentrate actually too. So depending upon what stage the buckthorn is, the concentration can vary.
Okay, these are about 1-2 inches in diameter.
Say, so basically, you can go about either a basal basal drench bark technique, or you can do a foliar application. Say, so if you do a foliar application, probably you can go with a 2-3% concentrate.
Okay, I would rather cut them down and get rid of them.
Yeah.
If you rather cut them down, I would first suggest see if you can go with the basal drench bark technique so that you spray the entire base, about 12 to 18 inches above the ground if you can. Put some little bit of a dye to it, okay, so that, and some oil. And then that will help in penetrating the Roundup solution into the bark. Or you can get actually a Gardelon type. That is a product called Pathfinder 2, which is pre-mixed with all this oil and dye. And that you can use all the way around. And once you kill those things and you see the dead stock, then you can actually mow them down to the ground or cut them down.
Garland Path?
No, that is a product by name called Pathfinder number 2.
Pathfinder number 2. Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, there's always lots that we can talk about here on Garden Talk, and we certainly have been covering the whole area, although we've zeroed in a lot on buckthorn today, and it's such a huge problem. I tell you, it's one that takes, as we've been talking about, a whole community working together. VJ Pandian is our guest today. VJ is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. He's been doing it for a long time now with some really good effect. Great to have him with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us today. Taking a look at your garden with VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. And there are some open lines, and actually we're taking any kinds of gardening questions. So join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Stacy on Facebook wonders, she has some iris bulbs that were dug late last spring. They've been in a box in her garage ever since. You're not the only one, Stacy. She's wondering if they're still viable.
Well, that's a great question. And first of all, I would check those bulbs, see what the healthy conditions looks like. If you do find any bulbs that are very rotten or mushy in appearance, toss those things off. And if the bulb seems to be clean and hard and pretty stouty in appearance, then probably you can plant them right now. Before you plant them, if you want to boost their growth, probably boost their root system, probably put some bone meals on underneath, and then you plant the, stick those rhizomes of those iris bulbs, and you cover it with some original dirt, water it, mulch it if you can, and that should do the trick.
All right, there we go. Let's go to Dan and Marinette next. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have two about 20-year-old autumn blaze sugar maples that are planted in my front yard. And they're both healthy, but they seem to be getting really thick. And I'm just wondering if it's advisable to have an arborist come and maybe thin out some of the canopy of these two trees, or are they better just kind of left to their own device?
So the thinning of the canopy on an autumn blaze maple, the timing is the critical thing right up here. We recommend to prune any of those deciduous trees in late winter, early spring before it buds out. I know that maples and like many other trees, you know, they're all in the bleeding category, which means that when you do prune them, like maples and birch, you know, they exude a lot of those saps. And those saps, you know, is not going to harm the healthiness of the tree to the great extent, so you can still go ahead and prune them in late winter, early spring. The reason for late winter, early spring is that that's a time the tree is starting to awake. So when you do any kind of major pruning on the branches, you know, the wound will be sealed much faster. So if you do it right now, you know, the tree isn't going in the dormant stage right now. Say the wound will be exposed to a longer period of time, and sometimes a cold temperature could further cause the split in the, you know, in the wound and can cause some form of damage. So certainly, you know, if you do have such a large tree, which is, you know, about 20-25 years old, probably I think it's best to call a certified arborist in your community to do those kind of pruning.
All right, there we go. And probably best in spring then.
Late winter, early spring.
Late winter, early spring. There we go. Good luck, Dan. Thank you. I want to go to Facebook on our visitor posts. Lyle sent a photo of a flower at Obrick Botanical Gardens, a flowered flower, I guess we could say, and wondering what kind of plant that is. VJ, can you tell from the photo?
Unfortunately, I don't know. I would appreciate if you could either, you know, email it to me, send it to your local extension agent, Lisa Johnson. Perhaps we can look into some of our reference book and we can able to narrow it down.
I'm not sure what it is either. I just don't know. But it's a pretty plant.
Looks pretty.
Very pretty. I can see why they wanted to know what it was. John in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I ran across a viney plant that's similar to, at first I thought it was poison ivy, but the leaves, there's five leaves to every stem, and it's changing red right now in fall. And I've known in the past, if you don't wear gloves and protect yourself, you will get similar burns to like poison ivy.
I'm kind of suspecting you're talking about Virginia winter creeper, actually, which is, you know, right now, they are the one of the few viney plants that first turns reddish and then they go into deep burgundy color later on. They usually have about like a five leaves, and it's pretty common to see them in the fences area or even in our landscape setting too. You know, you can spot them. Perhaps in terms of rashes, I'm not really familiar with, you know, whether it does has poisonous nature or not. I know the sensitivity varies from people to people. Say if you do feel some rashes, make sure, you know, to wear a long thick gloves. And if you do find some of those things, move immediately to a shade area and put up a wet towel on the top of those, you know, infected areas right away.
You were talking about another plant earlier that creates burns and so forth.
That is wild parsnip.
Yeah.
And that no way doesn't look like these things. And it doesn't have any fall colors or anything, you know. Say this one of the Virginia water creeper, you know, winter creeper is the one which has this kind of in a fall color right now. It's very distinct. You will find it anywhere in the landscape at this time.
All right. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Judy and Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Judy. Oh, we're losing Judy, unfortunately. I'm sorry, Judy, but we can't get through to you, so we're going to just switch and go right to Mike in Castle Rock. Mike, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have a pine tree here with a couple of big boughs that hang over the driveway that need to be cut. You know, you can't prop them up because they're too heavy. What is the best time of the year to do that?
Well, it depends upon your urgency of your situation, looks like. You know, if you feel that, you know, those branches are so heavy and that is a possibility that it could be hazardous, okay, especially when the winter is coming up and that's a possibility when the snow accumulates, you know, and it's going to pose a threat to your driveway, then probably, you know, I think you can trim them right now. If not, the best time would be late winter, early spring, you know, to trim those branches off, you know, those things. But right now, if you want to, you know, prune them a little bit, you know, so that it doesn't actually, you know, creep into your driveway or hang into your driveway, that's perfectly fine right now.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. We'll open lines and get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Mary in Wisconsin Rapids next. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I wanted to know where you'd like black walnuts delivered.
You got a few of them, huh?
Oh, boy, and I don't even have a tree. So I'm wondering how we could actually use these ourselves. I mean, the squirrels are great. They put them in my hanging flowers. I mean, it's just hilarious. They'll put them on my doorstep so I don't miss them. But how can you actually use these? Do you have to let that whole tennis ball look shrivel up?
You know, there are a lot of ways that you could, you know, try to remove those flush off of those, you know, knots, you know. First of all, I would suggest you to wear a thick gloves, actually, when you're handling those, you know, walnut, you know, if not any of those, you know, the saps could actually, you know, stain your, you know, your clothing materials and or even your hands too. It could be lasting longer. And second of all, you know, you could actually, you know, soak them in a, water, actually, you know, for a few hours or overnight, so that, you know, the outer fleshy one becomes actually pretty loose, and then you can actually, you know, mash them or try to remove them by hand, or you can use some sort of like a mechanical devices, you know, that can also help in removing those, you know, the husk out of that flesh. So, and then probably, you know, after you do remove those things, then probably you can air-dry those nuts, actually. And then probably, you know, you can test the quality of it, you know, if you place those nuts in a, you know, water, pail of water. If it's a, you know, a good quality nut, it sinks down. If not, if it's a bad, it just floats up, you know, then do your quality.
Throw those away.
Yeah, do a quality testing that in that way, too. But absolutely make sure to wear some good gloves or, you know, and... if not, it's going to really stain badly.
Okay, now when you said the pail of water, if they're good, they...
Sink,
okay. And then I wanted to also ask, when you said soak them in water, like overnight, should they be the green ones? Like some of them are dark shelled, you know, that tennis ball is dark brown already.
Yeah, okay. Usually, you know, we tend to recommend actually in a slightly darkened type of, you know, walnuts, okay, which are slightly showing some signs of a little bit, you know, over-ripening or decomposing type of thing. But if you do already have, you know, a mature dark green one, you know, use those things too, you know, and, but if the ball, if the nuts are, if the, you know, the husk is very small, then they're pretty much immature in size, and then you don't use those things, okay?
Okay, but we can soak them when they look like a tennis ball, when they're that...
Yep, when they're the tennis ball, yep.
Oh, okay. Well, we're going to try this.
Good luck.
Boy, oh boy.
Sure. You're going to have many hours of enjoyment in the winter months picking black walnuts. I'm telling you, it's a quite a chore. Get yourself some good picks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks for calling. Norman in Wausau has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Norman.
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask your guest, Larry, what is the likely problem? I have a number of different age, both pear and apple trees, and some of my senior apple trees that are 20 to 25, 30 years old, and pear trees are getting linear dead areas on the limbs and the trunk where the bark is peeling off and it's dead wood below. And last year, when I didn't brace them as well as I did this year, one of the pear limbs that was loaded with pears just broke off. It was about a 4-inch limb at the base where it went into the main stem. it just broke off, and I noticed the wood was almost all dead. There was just a small area of green cambium and a little what looked like might be live wood below it, so it couldn't support the fruit load. And these are not only on the south or southwest side, like Winterburn, but they're also straight up on the top of the limbs and on the north side of the limbs. And I'm wondering if that's from that 2013-14 record cold temperature when we lost a number of our other trees completely that following spring.
That's a great question, and I do see this type of question quite often from many orchard growers. In a see, one thing we need to realize that in a when you do have a stressed trees, apple trees and pear trees do get stressed out quite easily. Over the years, 3-4 years of continuous drought stress, if you have a lot of weed competition going underneath your tree, and those things could affect the lifespan of your apple trees and pear trees. So being your apple trees or pear trees are around 20, 25 years old, and if they do have a history of 4 or 5 years of continuous, moisture stress, a lot of weed competition going on, or rodent damage, all these things, okay? What happens is that, the bark gets thinner and thinner. Apples and pears, naturally, they do have a thin bark. And when you stress those trees, their bark gets furthermore thin, and then probably it's going to become succumb highly to winter injuries. And so from sun scald injury, frost crack, all those things could get in. When these barks starts about to start to split up due to winter injuries, the other pathogens from bacterial cankers or fungal cankers, they get into it and start decomposing the inner bark and further causing the collapse of the branches or the trunk of the tree. My best suggestion would be is to prune up all the dead branches off or whatever you have. Remove all the weeds around the tree. Easy to say, but it's a tough job. And put a thin layer of wood chip mulch. Wrap the trunk of the tree if the bark is still thin to prevent from rabbits or even from deer damage. And next year beginning, start watering them during the growing season. And early in the month of June, to spur up some growth, you can use some fertilizer, to spur some new growth into it and see how the tree responds in the next 2 to 3 years, and see how it goes. Now, sometimes if the tree is not responding that really well and still is in a declining mode, then think about replacing those things.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thanks, Norman. Appreciate the call. I have a photo up on our visitor posts from Rebecca, who wonders what she's looking at here. It looks like, she says, is this an elongated beet or radish? Looks like a beet.
And it has a long stalk too, and its leaves looks a bit different. I never came across such kind of an elongated beet like that. But it certainly looks like the color of those things looks like that as a beet.
Yeah, I would think so too.
Carrie, I'd be curious to know what kind of variety she's growing.
I would too. Carrie in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I was just wondering, our tomatoes this year developed bacterial speck, and we've read that you need to wait 1 to 2 years before planting again. So I'm wondering, is it the 1 or the 2? And I'm also wondering what other vegetables we could plant instead.
Well, with all the rain that we got in the early part of this growing season, even till about midsummer, tomatoes are highly succumb to a lot of different type of disease. And like you said, this year, I also noticed quite a bit of black bacterial specks and spots on one of my tomato varieties, too, that I've been growing in the demonstration garden. So when you do have these bacterial speck diseases, you can think about next year, if you do plant the tomatoes, to use some copper-based fungicide, Though copper-based is typically recommended for fungal type of pathogens, but on bacterial specks, you can use it too. But remember, these are preventive. Now, but the key thing when you're growing, if you do want to grow your tomato back again in that spot, make sure to clean up that area really well, do a good fall cleanup, remove any of the roots and any of the vegetation underneath, and you trash it, and maybe find another different spot in your landscape and plant your tomatoes. Make sure to give a sufficient spacing. If you do have an indeterminate variety, you need a minimum 3 to 4 feet apart, and try to train them in a large size cages. You know, use a concrete wire mesh cages, which are about like 4 feet tall or 5 feet tall, and train them in those cages system. And as soon as you start to see the early sign of this bacterial speck again, then probably, you know, apply those in a copper-based fungicide and see what happens. But again, when we have this constantly, literally rain every day, no matter what you spray, you know, you cannot stop these, fungal spore or bacterial spores infecting your tomatoes.
Okay.
Tell you what, I had great luck, though, this year with my straw bales. All my tomatoes were in straw bales. I got no disease, and the water, all the water made it really easy on me in terms of caring on, for those straw bales. And you could put those right over the top of where your problem area was.
Yeah. Good yard movement is very essential in it to minimize any type of bacterial or fungal type of, you know, leaf infection. Also, if you do think that, if you do have an indeterminate variety, prune them, some of those suckers off to let some more yard penetration happens up in the inner part of your tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you. And is there a different types that, or if we wanted to just not do tomatoes in that area this year, is there other plants that we could plant there instead?
Like you can go with like a sweet corn, cucumbers, beans, you know, you can try any of those things.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Harriet in Richland County. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have just a question that, see if you have any suggestions on or tips on, I'd like to move, have two raised beds full of hardy bulbs.
Okay.
Ranging from tulips to alliums to lilies. And do I just dig them up and set them aside and then move the box and soil and then replant the bulb? Is that all I have to do?
Well, if you do want to move them right now, yes, probably, yeah, you can scoop them out using a digging fork or some, you know, shovel if you have. Be careful of it. Scoop all those bulbs out, then relocate, move your raised beds and then put the dirt back again and then replant them. Before you replant them back again, you know, if you want to promote some better root growth, you know, you can put some bone meal underneath those, you know, planting holes, and then you can stuck these bulbs back again. And if this season seems to be dry, then probably water them up.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Dave in La Crosse. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for this topic on the buckthorns. I think that's really important. It's not a very conspicuous plant, but it's taking over the woods around here by the millions. And just wondered if there are pictures, if you can suggest where people can look for pictures of this plant, and if we can spread the word to community organizations such as the Hunters that somebody mentioned, and county conservation and
that sort of thing. Sure. I know the DNR has a nice publication.
Yeah, both DNR and UW Extension has a lot of wonderful publication information available. Say, if you Google up, you know, Wisconsin DNR invasive species, you know, you will find or come across in a their version of your articles and publications on the website. Or you go to our UW Extension website, either at learningstore.uwx.edu or our horticulture team website, or hot.uwx.edu. In both these websites, we do have a brochure on buckthorn, including common and glossy buckthorn and control measures. At our Learning Store website, we have Dr. Mark Renz, his publication on common and glossy buckthorn control, where he prescribed various management strategies, from mechanical prescribed burning to different sort of chemical ways to manage those things. He talked both pros and cons on those things. But to talk to your community members as well as creating awareness, you know, probably if you download the brochure at our horticulture team website, which is hot.uwx.edu, which would be a good starting point, actually, you know, to know more about this buckthorn, its history, distribution, and what are some management you can do.
Yeah, great information. And Tell you what, VJ, we had lots of questions about buckthorn. So it's obviously a big problem. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's always good to be here.
VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County, our guest. He'll be back and we'll do this again with him. Monday, UW Chancellor Rebecca Blank will be with us to talk about what's going on around the campus. And we'll talk about assisted living in Wisconsin as well. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.